listening to the AI in Motion podcast with JP Morgenthal. Hi, everyone. JP Morgenthal here with AI in Motion, the Everything AI in Supply Chain and Manufacturing podcast. My guest today is Patrick Gaughan. Patrick has been in the industry for quite a long time. He's had over 33 years at Fortune 100 company and a host of engineering management, supply chain, and quality roles. Most recently, he provided a combination of continuous manufacturing for traditional batching processes and global MES deployment strategies. So Patrick clearly has a finger on the pulse of what's happening in today's supply chain and manufacturing industries. Interestingly, Patrick was one of the first Lean Six Sigma black belts in his business unit in 1996. So, coming from not only the supply chain background, but the application of applying lean principles, which, I love that stuff. I have a counterpart in the industry, John Willis. He writes a lot about Deming, and it's been a big part of our thinking about DevOps in the IT industry, coming from this black belt training and lean training. So he's been a trainer for other black belts in the industry. He spent the majority of time working on plant process and product design. So understanding the end-to-end, which is something that we're going to look at today in today's episode, specific focus on one of the areas I really like, which is root cause analysis and leveraging automation and automation tooling to optimize and improve that environment. So welcome, Patrick. How are you today?
I'm doing fantastic, JP. Thank you very much for the opportunity to have a venue like this where we can talk about my favorite topic, which is all things that are manufacturing, portion of which includes lean manufacturing, near and dear to my heart, but also the supply chain piece as well, because my time in supply chain was, I think, very formative in terms of really understanding the business in a very different level, and certainly having an appreciation for its implications on the bottom line for any business. And whether that's manufacturing or not, I think that holds true for virtually every vertical.
Now, I want to dive in on a tangent real quick. Since sure. You raised both supply chain and manufacturing, right? Mm-hmm. They're related, but they're actually kind of really broad and discrete topics in and of themselves, yet often lumped together. And I'm curious why you think I get the relation. You can't manufacture something if you don't have a supply chain delivering right there. But from a systems thinking perspective, right, it's a workflow. It's A then B. I have my supply chain in, I have my supply chain out, and in between, I have my processing, my creation.
Right.
Right. And I get the workflow. So why has an industry grown up that takes this and kind of mashes it all together and tries to like talk about it as one big thing?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. I've never heard it quite phrased like that, but I think it comes down to the fact that in general, I think people that get into the supply chain side, they will follow a career path that lends themselves start to finish through supply chain quite often. And so the science around how you manage the supply chain and the value stream has a very fixed perspective. Let me make sure that I get materials to the point of use to be able to do the conversion work. And then let me make sure that I'm using data from the customers to be able to drive that as a primary input. And let me just kind of ignore the thing that happens in the middle. I'm just the supplier and the taker, and that's how it works. And so those folks will follow a track. Now, a lot of the folks that I ended up working with came from the engineering background, but landed in the supply chain space. And once they were in it, they found it interesting. Folks like myself that started in the ops side of engineering oftentimes will just stay through that track, right? And the supply chain is really kind of the thing that's just frustrated us all the time. And so we don't oftentimes have a lot of crossover in between those two to understand the dynamics of how these two things are very interrelated, obviously, right? But how they can impact each other in very, very specific ways. And a lot of that is focused on, quite frankly, data and workflow execution. And at its core, both those things have that in common, but the way that they handle and manage that data is very, very different, right? And we have to recognize why those differences exist and what can we do to ensure that we're really thinking about it as a whole, right? At the end of the day, the customer doesn't frankly care what it costs to convert things or whether something shows up early or slightly late, but I can guarantee you they sure care when the price goes up significantly and it shows up extremely late, right? And so I think, you know, bringing these worlds together is something that's going to happen, but because the data structure and the silos that have always existed, I think that's the bridge that keeps it apart. And I think that it's going to be a little while before we actually bridge that really, really well. But there's changes in both of those elements, I think, that help to bring those worlds together a little better than it used to.
Would you agree that that's where ERP systems really emerged as a topic years ago, was this attempt to coalesce for management a 360 view or a high-level view of everything that's happening in their business when they have that type of organization, when they have a product, right? You could be a retail store, you could make cars, right? But understanding that end-to-end flow from a financial perspective, I mean, that was my understanding of how ERP kind of really emerged, and it sucked from day one, let's be honest. I mean, the concept is brilliant. You could see, yes, the BCGs and the McKinseys of the world fingerprints all over something like that, because sure, they're strategic. They're like, you have to figure out how to get $20 million out of the cost of doing this in order to, you know, to achieve profitability faster. Okay, great. Love that. I'm Mr. CEO. Yep. I love that. That sounds great. How are we
can rally around that?
Well, this is a little company, SAP. They collect a bunch of data and they run some reports for you. You go get it, right? And it's like, but there's a gap between A to B that, in my opinion, SAP keeps getting better. They keep adding more. And yet that ultimate vision, I think, still doesn't come. Why?
Yeah, and I think it's almost by definition. So the promise of ERP was to get structure around data and processes in order to make things flow and to bring data to people in a way that makes sense, right? That's kind of at the 10, maybe 50,000 foot view, what it's intended to do. And in that, it brings structure to the data in fine order, right? But because ERPs are traditionally designed to be okay for all and not good for anyone in particular, it makes it very challenging to try to service all the masters with something that really fits the bill. And so what ends up happening is the folks on the ERP side will come in and convince you that all you have to do is to follow their rules and their guidance to be able to make things flow and everything will be just fantastic. And while that sounds like it makes a lot of sense, right, to bring rigor to the operation, in practice, it works, from my personal experience, it works very poorly in many cases, because businesses have oftentimes grown up over some period of decades and they've built in some measure of how they execute that business to service their customer. And those tools and systems that have made them good at what they do oftentimes are set back away from what ERP is intended to be able to do. And so it doesn't fit the business really well. So when we try to force fit the ERP model into a lot of these businesses, we start to see things that start to break down on the traditional sense. And then when you decouple the rigor that people had built in traditionally to be able to run the business to service their customers, and they try to slide over to the ERP side only to find out that, hey, I don't have that kind of, I'll call it flexibility to be able to do those things, you start to impart a lot of chaos on an organization. And there's certainly no shortage of folks out there that have horror stories of trying to be able to deploy some things. You know, one of the classic tales was Hershey, where they decided to deploy ERP right around Halloween, if I remember right.
No.
And they couldn't ship anything for months and it cost them tens of millions of dollars, right?
Worst point in time for Hershey to be doing that.
Yeah, yeah. And so that happens. And it's not like it was a bad ERP system. It wasn't like it was bad people trying to implement it. It was just the force fit needed a little bit more time to be able to saturate and to be able to do things in a way that brought order and structure to it. Now, the promise of ERP is generally that it's because it's systematic, you can end up with a lot less resources to do all the things that you were doing manually. I think in practical application, almost everyone will tell you that's not really the case. In fact, you should probably think about hiring more people to be able to manage the bridges for quite some period of time until you work through the rigor part of ERP. So the promise of we'll save you a ton of money on just the labor side because we'll execute for you versus here's the reality of having to try to juggle this business that doesn't really fit with what you have done historically. I think that there's all sorts of tales of woe about how that's played itself out. But what I don't want to do is I don't want to vilify either one of those models, right? The customers that have built a business case to service their customers very well that may be inefficient, or the ERP that seeks to try to do all the right things, irrespective of how the business did in the past.
It does go to a fine point that we've heard in the industry for years, which is the battle between customize or don't customize the ERP. Yeah. There's been a whole model that's emerged from the out of box thinking. The ERP out of box. CIOs have made their careers out of I can do ERP really efficiently because I take what SAP gives me because they're really smart at this, right? And so we use the out-of-box experience, but then you may be losing the flavor that the business has grown up with. So the alternative has always been spending millions to customize these systems so that it can embrace the nuance that make that business work today. And so that never works perfectly either. So it kind of what you just explained in a nutshell was the customize, don't customize debate and why neither one is really perfect. One, you're giving up who you are and trying to use generic, industry processes to run your business. But that's not the way you became who you are or became profitable. And the other way is trying to make ERP fit the mold of who you are. But that takes a long time and a lot of money. Yeah. So, which interestingly brings us maybe to our first topic in AI, right? Is that these ERP vendors are now starting to leverage the code development side of its generative capabilities to build the internal processes, the underlying code that for years consultants have charged millions to write that now it's going to write that code. You're basically going to have a supply chain manager working with a BA who's going to write a spec and say, this is the way we do business. And it's going to take that spec and it's going to generate all the BPAP, the BAPIs for you and prepare your system to implement your business process in weeks at nominal cost. I mean, do you think it's real? We know we can do it, but there's a lot that goes into that, right? I mean, it's a great vision, but
I may be in the minority in this a little bit in that I am a big advocate for the use of AI appropriately. I give myself fair license to say that we're going to screw it up because we're human. And things are going to go wrong, and hopefully it just doesn't go really wrong. And there are things that we can't come back from. But I don't share the philosophy that it's going to be this great pariah that's going to cause all sorts of problems and whatnot. I think it's going to solve a lot more than it causes. But in that, I think folks on the ERP side are starting to wake up to the fact that these monolithic software tools that they have traditionally sold and become extremely profitable at, right? You see where Larry Ellison is now the second, right, most wealthy person in the world. And, there's money behind that. And where there is money, there's also opportunity because competitors will see that. So think about the two topics we just started to cover, right? One, we've got systems that don't necessarily work so well for most people, but they can do some things really well. And now we've got this new tool set that comes up called AI that can tailor itself to the things that drive your business. And so I'm in favor of agentic AI, where you will start to find an ecosystem where you'll find agents that do things really, really well and very well tailored to what your business is and can be highly adaptive to whatever the situation is. And they will play a very specific role. And so the folks that are going to come out of this on the plus side are going to be the folks that put together all these agents that function as an ecosystem that delivers unparalleled capability and leverages data in a way that today is not being done. And I think at its core, that's really kind of the problem, is data and how it's used. And agentic AI is going to start to turn that on its ear and say, it doesn't matter, however you want to be able to use this data. We can just swap models out to use different things and do things almost on the fly and do it extremely well. Now, there's going to be plenty of failures along that pathway as well. And I'm sure those will be very well documented as we get there. But at the end of the day, you're going to see the cost of these types of systems just drop through the floor, because all of the time required to be able to build them starts to go away. Like you talked about, we're going to have folks that just put in, you know, specific prompts that can do things, and they'll just create agents. And these agents will get better and better and better because they're always feeding the model to improve themselves, right? And that's not what's done in ERP today, in, from my opinion. I'm sure that there's plenty of ERP advocates out there saying, happens. Oh, I'd love to argue that.
But it's called your supply chain manager. And if you have a good team.
Locally, yeah.
Hey, hang on 1 second. We're going to follow up on some of that thinking when we get back. Just take a quick break. And we're back. So when we left, we were just talking about, all right, so you're an AI fan. Everyone knows I'm an AI fan. And I agree with you. We are looking at, you know, the potential for enablement of taking what I would say this is AI as a whole, taking people's ideas and turning them into reality. I think that's what we've seen from 2024 on with Gen AI. It's just brilliant, right? They like to call it creators. That's a big name for it. But everybody can be a creator if you know how to use these tools, and you can create magnificent things. I'm reminded of my work when I had my company. One of my clients was a retail chain, and I would go to the headquarters, which was attached to the warehouse. And I became very friendly with the warehouse manager, Casey. Casey was great. I mean, this is New England, so you're getting the accent, hardcore warehouse manager. I can just imagine Casey sitting there, you know, and talking to the computer and telling him, "So you got to clean up my shelves because I can't find anything. Right? You got to tell me where I got to put everything now." So, and I can imagine some agent going off and determining, you know, okay, I've built you an agent to evaluate where everything is on the shelves today that I know of, and where things should be shuffled around and replaced. And here's your plan. And, you know, now let me tell you where the plan falls apart. 70% of the staff have been in that warehouse for the past 20 years and just throw crap wherever they can when it's overstocked. I got no space for it. I'm using for returns. I got a box over here. I got stuff. So there's rigor, but there's people rigor too. And the people will ultimately mess up your agents no matter how hard you try.
Yeah.
It's just the reality of the beast, right? I mean, but tell me, so you've been in manufacturing. So tell me this, that's a lot more rigor. Everything is pristine in that flow. Tell me about the inputs to the flow, though. Give me a horror story.
Well, I will give you sort of a high level horror story that hopefully will resonate with some folks, because we're talking about supply chain and manufacturing together, right? And so the business that I came from was 100% tied to the auto industry, and the auto industry, as you know, is a tough place to live, right? Okay. A lot of folks don't get into it because, heaven forbid, you should do something that shuts down the customer line. You're going to get a bill for $100,000 an hour for every hour that it's down. So it keeps mom and pops pretty much out of that business. So the competition is not for the timid, and it's not for the ones that have short pockets.
So were you tier one, tier two?
We were tier one.
Tier one. Wow. Okay.
Yeah. Well, actually, we played at tier one and tier two because we supplied paint to the components that went on the cars as accessories as well. Right.
Okay.
So, so we got to see, you know, quite a bit of the supply chain from that perspective. So imagine, if you will, and this is kind of an understood truth throughout the industry. I can predict with pretty decent precision how many builds are going to happen in the United States year over year. I can look at trends, I can look at some macroeconomics, and I get a good feeling. And so we would do our five-year planning based on where do we think the builds are going to be, right? So that you can do really, really fairly well. What becomes a little bit more tricky is who's going to get the builds. So now I've got a level of uncertainty that happens there, right? And then below that, what are the models that are going to be the ones that are going to be sold, right? A little more uncertainty there. And then eventually I get to the part that really impacted us was, well, what's the color palette going to look like, right? And so every single one of those levels brings in another layer of uncertainty. So while I can predict, and I know, you know, pretty much at a top line level, what that aggregate's going to be.
You're waiting for the marketing really people the to color. Do their job before you can even get started on ordering what colors you need, what tints you need.
Yeah. And so we started the process of introducing those colors about 8 years before they would actually become commercial. So we were starting to sort of cultivate the palettes of what the color space is going to be. And
Smart. You managed up.
Well, yeah. And I hate to say it, but we would actually look at fashion trends as a precursor to how many years later it would show up in the cars. That was as complicated as it went.
Oh,
so
cool.
That was a little bit of the mystique around it. Right. But my point in that is, while I can predict high level things fairly well, it's when I start to get into what's the consumption rate on a week to week basis, that's where the chaos really happens, right? Because now I've got customers fighting each other for batches that are trying to leapfrog each other. I've got losses that were unexpected. I've got supply chain interruptions, right? So it didn't change the high level number. The builds were the builds. But to figure out what are all the subcomponents that go in at that lowest level becomes an immense and immeasurable challenge. And the only way you can start to overcome that type of chaos is to put some rigor in place in ways that in some cases are not all that intuitive. So you've heard a lot of people talk about moving to a JIT model, right?
Yep.
And that was foundational to Toyota's success as part of their larger TPM strategy. And JIT doesn't mean, well, let's just shrink down the inventories. That's not the point. The point is to have a robust process that can very quickly start to produce at whatever the rate is that the demand suggests it needs to be, okay?
Right.
And that's fantastic, right? You can produce batches at a high rate, you can keep up. But it's only as good as the data that you have going in terms of what were the colors that were to be produced, right? And so what ended up happening, to kind of put a bow around this, is that everything started with the ERP, right? And it said, here's my lead time for all of these materials. Here's my expectation of accuracy on my forecasts. And those things generally became very static numbers, but they were used in all the calculations that drove everything. And that's the horror story, right? So we had the opportunity.
Is it true that this made Excel?
What's that?
Is it true that this is what made Microsoft Excel?
Microsoft Excel was everywhere. And in fact, up until recently, it would have been Microsoft Access and now Power BI. And that's in part because when you see the chaos that ensues in this, you end up with a whole group of citizen developers. And all of these fine and well-intending people, they couldn't write code. None of us could really write code. That's not what we did. We weren't, you know, computer science guys.
Right.
But we could function in Excel and we could do things in Access and Power BI to solve the very specific problems that we had. And so now you start working with the ERP and the ecosystem of support tools.
The shadow IT.
Yes, we call them the hidden factories, right? And so we were not alone in that by any stretch. Every one of my fellow engineers that worked in other plants that I worked with, they did the same thing. All the folks that supplied us did the same thing. I mean, it's sort of an industry-wide understood chaos measurement tool that really starts to become prevalent in the space. And so
like
that's the horror story
to me.
What's that?
This seems like a business opportunity to me to take that and turn it into a AI program, like let AI turn this into a program for you.
Yeah. And I want to put a little spin on that. So not only is there a huge opportunity for AI to do some things much, much better in that space, But there's a core concept that's really starting to gain some prevalence, where we're starting to look at this this DDMRP system, where you're starting to have specific disconnects in the supply chain so that you manage these blocks of inventory as isolated islands, so that you can have the buffers that are appropriate, because the high level data operates at one level of uncertainty, right? And that is actually fairly small. And the further you go down in that distribution, whether that be in your warehousing or structure or even local storage of inventory, you start to have these buffers. And if they're connected, which is what ERP intends to do, is to connect all the way up, because you need that thread, right? Your building materials all the way through your planning. Then once that's hard coded, you've got problems that you can't get out of. And AI is going to start to recognize, hey, let's just do a little bit of decoupling here, a little decoupling there. And suddenly we've got a robust system that we can manage with a different set of rules. ERP is one rule, and the DDMRP piece of it now becomes a series of rules that manage independently and can handle that chaos a whole lot better.
Well, just curious, what does that buffering look like in reality? Like, is it like almost like an oversubscribe kind of concept? I'm going to put it an extra 10% in production, and going to, you know, warehouse it, or, you know, drop it in.
Not at all. It's far more sophisticated. What it seeks to do is it takes a look at what is the fundamental underlying data that drives that particular bucket, right? And how do I manage that? So when I describe the high level, think of a coding system as a mix of solvents and resins and colors, right? Yep. And it just says, okay, I'll manage that for what it is. And I know what those aggregate numbers are. But now when I start to get into those regional warehouses, now I've got differences in technologies that are being supported, where some folks maybe are water-based and some are solvent-based, and they have different types of chemistries, and different customers they serve will disconnect from that. And then you start to get more local, which is, okay, well, what are you guys supplying locally to your customers specifically? I'll manage that differently. And then I even get down to maybe even on the color palette side, I'm just going to look at your local demand, and I'm going to disaggregate that, and I'm going to manage that portion. So you end up with little buffers of pieces that are meaningful to the buckets in total. And so you manage the chaos differently because the data supplying it is different.
That's
it's not
totally
the same.
Wild. It almost trades off real estate, like you're doing smaller in more places than doing large in one place.
Yeah. Yes. That's exactly the way to think of it.
That's cool.
And the logic between them is you're using different data. And so the output is the same. You just want to keep everybody,
a little more logistics,
with the right color paint at the right time.
A little more logistics, right? I mean, you're taking the output of a sub-process and moving it in and making it available to the next tier up in the process.
There's a fantastic body of work that really speaks to how to do that well. And the folks that really live JIT do it well, this whole notion of something simply called milk runs. And so what they seek to do is to say, well, let's just figure out what these regular runs are going to be and not micromanage. When am I going to ship something to someone? Let's agree that I've got a route of facilities that I need to drop things to. And let's agree that I don't know what it's going to be tomorrow. But whatever it is right before tomorrow, when I load that truck, I'll do those calculations at that time. I'll take it, I'll put it on the milk run, and I'll go make that delivery. And so what ends up happening is, even though that sounds counterintuitive, well, wait a minute, you're going to be delivering to warehouses more frequently, and that's going to not cost more money. No, in fact, it costs less money because you're much more responsive in it. And again, gets to that bucket of creating that disconnect and just saying, I will react at the last minute to what you need. And it won't feel like a rush, right? Because part of the problem today is, oh, well, let's do expedited freight and send a piece here, a piece there, a piece there. And that's where the cost comes into play. And here now we're sending out full trucks.
Yep. Right. I mean, it's butterfly effect. Lack of full trucks. It's waste in the system. It's people who are buying more than they need. So that changes the demand after that, right? I bought 100,000 pieces, but I to cover myself, but the actual demand was only 70,000 pieces. So now I'm stuck with 30,000 pieces. I'm not buying from you for a while. I don't need it. I got it in my warehouse, right? I got to use up what I have. So that affects your quarterly, your nice distribution, give you a much more variable flow. And if you're a public company, man, that's awful, right? That's kiss of death, right? Because it's like you were expecting good numbers for quarter three. Guess what? No, because everyone got used to you being the guy that screws up, so they buffer themselves, and then you're not getting the orders.
Right.
You can't normalize that consistency in the flow. But you're telling me with this model, you generate a much more consistent flow. So it's better from a financial perspective for businesses.
Yeah. I
mean, executives must love it.
Yeah, absolutely. What you're doing is you're starting to trade off a little bit of extra inventory for a hell of a lot more flexibility that allows you to be able to flow in the process. And you hit on a real interesting point, JP, and that is working capital as a primary tool to be able to govern the business. And so two problems kind of come to bear in a very similar way. One is the minute that you introduce humans into the decision-making process and a human has been burned because they were caught red-handed, they didn't have the materials that they needed at the time. Human nature is, I will solve that problem by getting more, right? Just like you pointed out. And so they will do that repeatedly, and suddenly I've got a blow up in working capital.
It's hoarding, right?
It is hoarding, absolutely. Right? Yeah. And it's done without the rigor of everyone doing it the same way. Everyone's doing it differently. Right. Yes. Because their pain point was different. Well, now suddenly you don't have a system anymore. You've got a problem that's starting to broil out of control. And so the very dollars that you would love to be able to put into equipment to be able to do better with your business, suddenly you have all the money tied up in inventory.
Oh, no.
And now I'm inefficient and I'm stuck in a bad place. And heaven forbid the company try to introduce new technology to become better in the marketplace. And all of a sudden, all those materials that they've got sitting there are not even useful anymore. And there may not even be a place to get rid of it, right? That's a huge problem.
Yeah.
Second problem is, if you're like a lot of businesses and you have defects, because process variability is a normal thing, right? You will experience that same aggregation of working capital in the form of defective material. And I can think back to an example where I was asked to go to a plant to figure out what was wrong. And I went to the plant, mapped it all out, looked at everything. And I said, hey, give me a list of all of your inventory. Let me see it. And they said, oh, well, here's our number. It's just for argument's sake. Let's say it's $10 million. And I said, okay, I want to go see it. And I saw this pale color come over the plant manager's face. And he said, okay, we'll walk you out to the warehouse. I went out to the warehouse, did a little simple math. I said, okay, I think you've got about $2 million sitting here. Where's the other $8 million? And he looked at me more pale and he said, Pat, he said, we have a problem and we're working off our defective material a little bit at a time every month so that we can get that number down without popping their head up to be lopped off. Right. And it was a very real problem. So here they were hamstringing their business and going hand to mouth on the materials they needed because they had all these defects that had aggregated over years under old management. That they couldn't, they didn't have
the write down for it. They should have just taken a write off and been done with it. And
yes.
Yeah. Instead, they try to eat a little, it's like skimming off the top.
Yes, exactly right.
Yeah.
That's a great analogy. My counsel to my good friend who was the plant manager was, listen, you just took this job over in the last couple months. You've got 6 months before it's your problem. Right. My suggestion to you is bite the bullet, hit the bottom line and take the lashings and really help the business. And that's what he ended up doing. So
smart.
He took a lot of heat for it, but it was the right thing to do. And they got better and better from that point forward.
And it was great advice because, again, he just walked in, so it wasn't his problem.
Yeah.
If he waited too long, then it would have got pinned on him, and then he would have been in big trouble when he did.
Exactly.
So it's like,
exactly.
That's what you come in. You hired me. I found this problem. Let's clean it up. Let's get rid of it and just take a bite. Yeah. So we have just a little bit of time left, but but everything we just talked about really harkens for me the need for focusing on your data. As we enter this AI realm, as I like to say, as we move towards this autonomous enterprise, right? You know, everybody wants to dive in to the pool. It's amazing. You know, if you translated what people are doing and the risk level to a physical reality, right? It's like you have a pool that's 22 feet deep and you have people who can barely swim who look at it and go, oh, that looks fun. I want to go off the diving board. And nobody in their right mind in that scenario would dare jump off the diving board. Well, you have a very, like 2% population that would jump off the diving board into the 22-foot water if they don't swim well. They just wouldn't do it. But because they don't understand the ramifications, and it seems real simple. Look, I can jump in here. Look, I can make this nice video. I can tell it to draw me a cute picture. They think nothing of like just diving in and becoming citizen developed, building that, you know, entire universe on Excel, on the basis of Excel, right? My entire distribution chain and what I'm ordering and my plan is all based on my Excel models and some access databases, right? Yeah. People will do that. And with AI, I think it's just really going to put them in a bad space. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm just being too cynical. I mean, we both agree, I know we do, about the need to get your data house in order now. But yeah. I mean, what do you think is going to happen when people just start diving into the pool of the diving board and realize they can't swim?
Well, I live my life by the credo that the greatest lessons I've ever learned in life were 5 seconds after I needed them. Okay. And you're going to see a lot of folks that are going to understand that one little statement much more so as a result of what you're talking about, which is, hey, mistakes are going to be made and things will happen. One of the big challenges with AI is, unlike, say, Excel, I can follow the calculations all the way through and see where my errors are. AI, it does things, and there's logic behind it. We can't act like it's really magic. It's not at all. It's just driven by models that we can't really follow well. Now, there are some folks out there that are starting to create traceability models that can allow you to step through the logic to understand why things happen. And I my hat's off to that, because I think that's an area that has to happen for this to go well. But the part where it's going to start to actually work really, really well is that when you look at traditional supply chain mathematics, you're not looking for a single point that says, here's what my lead time is. Frankly, that average lead time number is not the driver for what you use to drive your supply chain. It's the variation component around that number that drives your inventory levels. Here's the problem. In ERP world, you have one place for one number generally. What's my safety stock? What's my reorder point?
Right, thresholds, right?
Right? And you ask anybody, because I do it all the time, we're out there consulting, right? How often do you change that number in ERP? Well, I don't know, maybe quarterly, maybe annually, maybe, I don't know, maybe I didn't ever change it. Right. I put it in, right?
I know people that have never touched it.
Never touched it. And that is the fundamental problem that we, as practitioners in the world of manufacturing, need to get over. We need to get to dynamic calculations of what is that lead time, and we need to be proactive in either helping those suppliers reduce that variation. I don't care if the average goes up, quite frankly. As long as the variation comes down, that's a good thing. And then hang those calculations off of that performance change. Because if COVID didn't teach us anything, it was that when a crisis state happens, it cascades not with a little ripple. That's a tsunami that just rips through everything and starts to really have a dramatic impact. So the variation is going to go up significantly as a result, and we have to react to that in a way that's commensurate with what's appropriate, right? And that may mean looking at alternative sourcing. It may mean working with the supply base to get those times back down. It may mean that I carry short-term extra inventory to handle the chaos and whatnot. And that's just one example, right? I mean, there's geopolitical events that are doing the same thing today.
On that point, let me just ask your opinion.
Yeah.
What is the right interval to examine your variance? Because you don't want to be totally reactive, like, you know, chicken without a head. Oh my God, it went from 7 to 9. We got it. You know, every day you don't want that, right? So it's got to be like, it's okay that, you know, how often are you checking that interval, or how do you normalize that interval? Right. Over time.
So I'll tell you what we tell our clients, and that is that we want to take a look at your time, actual times for when did I request for a replenishment and when did I actually receive it? That's the real time. And I want to do that with every single order you have. And I want to be able to use that data to calculate those things. What's my mean? What's my standard deviations for that? And I want to keep feeding that into the model. Now, you're absolutely right in that if I react to a single data point and I take that last one and make it the only one, that could be very problematic. However, right. Let me go back to an analogy.
The AI doesn't know that. That's the thing.
It has no idea, right? But what you can do is you can start to do something. So and I'll try to make this a practical application. So we compounded raw materials, right? And in the course of doing that, we were adding liquids to tanks, right? Very simple, straightforward, right? Unfortunately, in some cases, your weight addition going into that tank may have been from several feet away. And so you've got material that's in free fall, right? And so you've got to account for that and anticipate when are my automated methods going to cut that off and say, okay, I'm looking to hit a target. And if I wait too late, right, I'm going to overshoot. If I stop too early, then I have to do small dosing drips to be able to get there. So there's algorithms you can use that look at some measure of smoothing to say, okay, I understand that I'm doing something in anticipation of an event that hasn't happened yet, but I can do that reliably, and I can become predictive in a way where I can hit that point very, very reliably, in spite of the fact it's not even real, right? It hasn't even happened, but I know how to react to it in anticipation. So, and oftentimes you'll do that through just a series of polling steps, right? So I'll count the last 12 data points and add that last one, which has a lot of variation in that one, right? And I can start to compress that down to something that I can actually react to very reliably. So it's just algorithmic in terms of how you manage that signal. And I think AI can very easily detect those sorts of patterns and help.
Yeah.
And so my short answer to that is I would use data all the time, every day. And as that starts to track, react to that accordingly. I don't think any of those data points should actually be completely static. I think they should be calculated at a very high frequency and pull them at the right rate that you don't become overreactive. You know, think of it like a traditionally a PID loop, right? As it's trying to harmonize its way out and steady. Same type of logic. That's probably a bad analogy.
The industry producing, and maybe individual companies have, and they just aren't sharing them at this point because, you know, supply chain manufacturing are not well known for their participation in the tech sector and contributions back to open source, right? But it would be interesting to see some of these tools appear for the LLMs. You know, they have this MCP architecture, which allows you to connect tools to your LLM. And then the tool you can create a calculator, and then the calculator becomes a tool. So the LLM, instead of trying to do math, which we know it can't do, because it actually does 10 times 10 by looking at where have I seen 10 times 10 before, instead of actually calculating 10, right. 10 times. It sees, I have a calculator. I'll use the calculator tool. This sounds like a great opportunity for, you know, to build these algorithms as tools to connect to the LLM, right? You know, what's my Varian smoothing tool to tell me what my threshold should be, so that you could say to the LLM, you know, based upon, you know, here are my last, you know, Here is the tool to look at all my orders and receipts. So now I know when that was ordered, when it was received. Okay. And here's the tool to figure out my variance. Tell me what you think I should set my threshold to today.
Yeah.
And every day you could get a report that's run that goes through that and tells you if you should update that threshold. Or you could just have it update the threshold. I mean this is where this stuff
Full disclosure, we've actually already done that with a company called Magic Software, and for that very reason, because we recognize that this is a need not just for manufacturers, but really for every industry. And so we created an application that has an AI component that actually goes out and does that because it's looking at the real data. And so right now we're in early testing phase with it. That wasn't the purpose of our getting together today, but since you asked, I guess that this is a great place to talk about
Fair enough, man, I asked.
there's a lot of good minds out there that recognize the need for that. And there's folks out there that have experience in this field that are going to start to react to that and start to put it together. And quite frankly, supply chain is just one piece of the puzzle, right? These opportunities to do really, really valuable insights on intelligence for operations are going to start to unfold in very rapid succession because AI enables us to be able to do these things very, very quickly. Will they do them well or not? Hard to say.
Last question. Tier 2, tier 3 suppliers not being able to keep up technologically. In the past, it's been a problem. I mean, you know, we all know the horror stories about fax machines were still in use in tier three suppliers for orders when tier one was General Motors, and they're like, we're EDI using EDI, right? You know? So your EDI order is going through a process somewhere in a van that becomes a fax to the, and hope that it got picked up off the machine and didn't roll off or paper wasn't out of paper, right? Yeah. How do you, what's going to happen here? What's your opinion of what we're going to see with tier two, tier three mainly, suppliers feeding the supply chains technologically?
Yeah, my opinion on this, because everybody's going to have opinions, right, is that over time, what you're going to start to see is that the OEMs are going to recognize more and more what that liability starts to look like. And they will be the ones leading the investment charge to actually take AI agents that actually work really, really well because they've honed them and exposing them to tier one, tier two, tier three, so that they can gain visibility throughout the entirety of the value stream. I think the challenge to that is going to be, you know, there's going to be an innate pushback on folks kind of opening the kimono to say, okay, you can see, you know, how our business is moving and how we're doing things and whatnot. And so they're going to have to get over the value component of that versus the transparency. And there'll have to be sort of an awakening to the fact that if you embrace this, you'll be one of the ones that will survive and thrive. And if you try to keep everything close to the vest, you're probably going to be one of those ones that'll get worked out of the supply chain at some point. I think that's really what we're probably going to see, because it will be, it should be from the OEMs giving that no charge to the rest of the supply chain to just feed their data.
Is there a model for that with other technologies?
Not yet. Not that I've seen. And you know what? Hopefully some of the folks that watch this will weigh in and say, well, hey, wait a minute, that is going on and it's going on in a big way. And here's what we're excited to talk about. Maybe that's your next guest, right? But I think in my mind, that's what my opinion believes is going to happen.
Awesome. Well, Pat, I tell you, I think there's a lot more we can uncover, and I hope we do another one in the future, because this is, I really believe this is going to be a very popular episode. I just think that there's a lot of meat in here that a lot of supply chain executives and executives in manufacturing companies are going to want to hear, and they're going to want to know more. So they can reach out to you where?
Right up here, Axiom Manufacturing Systems, LLC.
Oh, you're cut off on my, I'm sorry.
I can't even see it.
I will put it in the link when we publish this. And likewise, Nexigen Solutions also helping you with your AI adoption. Pat, thank you again for coming today. As I said, I'm looking forward to doing another one in the future.
Yeah, fantastic. I'm all for it. I'm a huge advocate for manufacturing, and anything I can do to help foster that here, especially growth in the United States, I'm all about.
Fantastic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, JP.